Thank you for attending this session. It's number 355, titled Seeking the Spirit, Supplementing Spiritual Practices. As you're coming in, try to sit towards the front. Please silence your cell phones. That would be appreciated. As you listen today, we invite you to explore what it means to be Mormon. Who gets to carry that label? What does the history say? What does the theology say? At this conference, we encourage you to explore what it means to be Mormon. We ask you to reflect on your own Mormon interactions and to hold the good and the bad together to create a more full, complete, personal narrative. In doing this, we allow others to do the same. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please consider purchasing Sunstone merchandise to support Sunstone, including tradable lanyard pins with prominent figures in Mormonism. There is also a wide variety of popular Sunstone chapsticks, mugs, bags, and more. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both the audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. A little about this particular session. Many Mormons seek ways to supplement their spiritual and religious practices outside the walls of the chapel. This panel will explore a variety of ways different Mormons have sought to increase a connection with the divine. Kelly Reese has been teaching Anusara yoga and multiple supplemental trainings in various teaching styles for 6 years. She has a BS in business administration and a BS in marketing from the University of Utah. Maxine Hanks is a Mormon feminist theologian who compiled and edited the book Women in Authority: Reemerging Mormon Feminism. She was excommunicated on September 19th, along with fellow contributor D. Michael Quinn. In February 2012, Hanks was rebaptized into the LDS Church. Thomas is an author, public speaker, and mindfulness teacher. He holds a faculty position at Pacific Integral, where he teaches developmental psychology and incorporates his nearly 20 years of experience practicing mindfulness. He is the creator of the acclaimed podcast Mindfulness Plus and has been featured on NPR, Religious News Service, and Radio West. We will now turn the time over to the session.
Thank you. Thanks for that introduction. Thanks, everybody, for attending this after-lunch session, where it's much more tempting to take a nap than to engage in spiritual practice. We kind of put our heads together before this session and felt that it would be appropriate to start with some practice, some direct experience into spiritual practice rather than talk about it. And we are lucky to have Kelly here to lead us in a little bit of yoga. It will be gentle yoga, not worried about heaving up your burrito after lunch yoga. Nice and gentle to help the digestion, to help get your body moving, your energy up. So without further ado, we'll have Kelly start us off, and I'm gonna vibe out the lights.
I would invite anyone who would like to. I'm going to, because these shoes are tall, take off my shoes. So if you feel like you're okay taking off your shoes, you don't have to. Go ahead. But it will be less embarrassing for me if I don't fall. So, okay. Can you guys all hear me without the microphone? If I stand over here?
We want the recording, so please.
Okay. So if you've taken off your shoes, get comfortable, uncross your legs if they're crossed, maybe cross at the ankles if you prefer, and just begin to sit with yourself for a minute. In the yoga classes that I teach, we're very much mindfulness focused. We begin with a meditative kind of introspection, with breathing, with an attention to detail to our breath that takes us into what we call a yogic breath or an ujjayi breath. And this allows us to move into our physical practice very single-minded. And we do this because yoga is not as much about the physical practice as it is about the word yoke, which is where yoga comes from, the word yoga. It means to yoke mind, body, and spirit. So when we combine all of these little pieces together, we achieve something that is a whole body experience. And you can go to an aerobics class and find an exercise experience. You can go to a lecture and find a thoughtful experience. And you can go to church and find a spiritual experience. And we try to combine a little bit of that in all of our yoga classes. So we begin by closing our eyes. So if you wouldn't mind, close your eyes and begin to become a witness to your own thoughts. It's after lunch. Maybe your thoughts are very sleepy. Maybe you've had a lot of information introduced today and you're sorting it through. Just notice that. Be aware of that it's there. You don't have to pay a lot of specific attention to it. But just notice that it's there and start to become a witness to how you're feeling physically, the thoughts that are going through your mind's eye, any physical things going on in your body. And as you become more and more aware of them, pay more attention to your breath. Where are you breathing? Is it a high breath up in your upper chest, a bit shallow, maybe from running from conference to conference, finding rooms? Just notice it and let it be as it is. Place one hand on your heart, just in the sternum area, and one hand on your belly. And as you hold your hands here, we hold one hand over our heart for spiritual connection and one hand over our belly for grounding. And if you wouldn't mind, sit up a little taller in your chair. Maybe sit forward so that you're not leaning back into your seat. And as you sit this way, notice where your breath is. Your upper hand on your chest may rise and fall as you take that breath in. And be aware of your hand lifting, moving back down with each breath. And then continue to focus as your mind wanders. You may find that your mind goes back to all those thoughts that you're having for the day, where you're going next, what you've already been doing, the rest of the weekend's plans. As your mind wanders, bring it back to your breath. Inhale, exhale. In breath, out breath. And then make that in breath a little bit longer. As you breathe in and notice the sounds in the room and the chatter outside, the sound of my voice, bring your awareness back to your inhale, making it longer, deeper, until you can feel maybe even your hand on your belly rise and fall. And then let your exhale lengthen out with this next breath. So it becomes a very deep and as you control that exhale, it becomes more and more long with each breath. With this breath, you can find a little bit of calming of the nervous system. You can begin to focus more on the thoughts that you choose instead of the monkey mind, as we call it, jumping from branch to branch. A couple more breaths in this deepened fashion. Maybe just listening to the sound of the air as it moves in, fills your lungs, swirls around. And then listening to the sound as you exhale, breathing out slowly. And take your hands and place them together just in front of your heart, sort of in a prayer pose, but with your thumbs touching the front of your chest. And for just a moment, bow your nose towards your fingertips. We hold this pose as Anjali Mudra. The mudra is a hand gesture. It's honoring that self inside you, that person that goes by your name and walks around in your body, that authentic self that is only you, uniquely you. No one else can ever be this self because you take up this space. You offer this unique self to the world.
And in this mudra, honor the coming together of that self with body and mind. Go ahead and release your hands, lift your gaze, open your eyes. And I'm going to put this back in here so I can do these poses with you. So while you're sitting, take a look to your left and take a look to your right. Just notice who's around you, notice the room. Awareness is a big deal in yoga. Awareness of your surroundings, awareness of yourself. And let's take a big breath in, that same deep breath that you just found, and take your arms wide or out in front if your neighbors are close, and get big and tall and reach up and stretch really, really big. And with the exhale, you're going to bring your hands right back down into heart center. Good. And we'll marry breath and movement. So reach up tall or out in front, get as big as you can. And then as you exhale, come back down. Good. One more time. Reaching tall, stretch almost to the ceiling, get as big as you can, and come back down. Right to heart center. Good. And let's take a couple of stretching poses. So reach your arms out to the sides. And we'll cross. I'm going to mirror you guys. So I'm going to cross my right arm in front and bend my elbow. Good, so just your forearm is right in front. You're gonna take your left arm and set it on top or as close as it wants to come. So we have this kind of crossing of the arms and this nestling of your left arm on top of your right arm. And you can take this pose here or you can cross again if you have room there. Good. And then I want you to lift your elbows and see if you can feel a nice stretching. It looks good. It looks good. I like it. See if you can feel a nice stretching all through the upper back, all through those muscles that a lot of the time we are walking around like this because we're doing things that require us to bend over like this. Get those muscles lengthen out and get long. And let's open up arms wide. And we'll switch sides. This time, we're going to take the right arm in, or the left arm, excuse me, left arm in. Then right arm nestles on top. And in whatever way your pose takes shape, let that happen. If your arms touch together, if they cross over right here and that's where they land, this is called eagle pose or eagle arms. Find your version of the pose and then let those elbows lift and find a stretch on the other side. Good. And as you're lifting your elbows, lift your gaze, lift your heart. Let this pose be expressive of all the amazing and wonderful yourself on the back. And if that's far away, just take your hand as far, your arm as far as it wants to go. And then you're going to take your other arm up and over and find your elbow. For our friends who are feeling super flexible today, you may find this grip. This is something that comes with time. So you can work it and see if the fingers are good. As you press your head back into your arms, feel that stretch happen all through and soften the shoulders down. Good. Go ahead and release. And we'll take the second side. So left arm comes across, right arm, sorry. It's really weird when you're switching and teaching yoga classes. And this doesn't look like a normal yoga class. One standing pose today. It's one of my favorite poses, and it's called tree pose. Most of you have probably seen this pose. So if you have a chair in front of you and you'd like to use it for balance, please do so. We're going to take both of our feet, take a look at your feet, and if they're in your shoes, imagine your toes spreading and planting your toe pads down onto the floor. Feel all four corners of your feet touching the floor or in through your shoes down into the floor, and shift your weight over onto your right foot.
take a little bend into your left knee. And then you're going to turn your left toes out to the side. Good. Now, your tree pose might stay right here. This might be where you live, and that's a great tree pose. Or you can take that foot up to the calf and stay right here. Hands can be on hips, or your hands can be touching the chair in front of you for balance. I'm not going to do it because I'm wearing a dress, but you can take that foot all the way up to your upper inner thigh. You can use your hand to give you a lift to put your foot there. Wherever you're at, press your foot into your leg and your leg into your foot. Hands come together at your heart. Touch your palms together and press lightly. So everything is down the center line of your body. And this hip likes to get a little sassy sometimes. So if it's getting sassy on you, draw it back in so it's in the midline. Good. And if you want to let your tree go ahead and open your arms tall. And if you want to get real crazy, you can try looking at the ceiling. But you may want to warn your neighbors. That goes for balance. They might catch you. You never know. Good. Go ahead and release that pose, and let's try the second side. We're going to reaffirm our connection with the earth here, and just take a look at the floor. Spread the toes. Press your toe pads back down into the floor, and shift your weight over onto your left foot, and lighten up on the right foot. Turn your toes to the side, and maybe you stay here. This is a great way to do tree pose, because everything that happens with your foot lifted is happening here. Either stay here or take your foot to the side of your calf and stay here if you like, or take your foot all the way to the upper inner thigh. And when you find that balance, let your hands come to heart center. Good. Pause here for a minute. Draw your standing hip in so it's in the midline. And maybe even find a way to incorporate that breath, that deepened breath we found earlier. Find it here. And maybe even allow all the thoughts that are happening about balance and whatever it is that's going through your mind, allow that to pass on through and your thoughts to only focus on inhale and exhale. And then let your tree grow. Good. Beautiful. And if you want to, you can look at the sky. This right away balance comes into perspective, right? And at the end of each yoga practice, we put our hands together and we say the word namaste, which means the light in me sees and honors the light in you, and you would say that back to me. So we'll end this practice, this little mini practice, with the same fashion and the same respect for each other and seeing the light that exists in all of us. So the light in me sees and honors the light in you. Namaste.
Namaste.
Thank you.
All right, so we want to engage in a community of practice in this session. We want to experience spiritual practice directly, and we'll also have time to say a few words about spiritual practice from our own perspectives. And we'll leave plenty of time at the end of the session, a half hour or so we can just kind of mash up the topic together and offer questions and be thoughtful about how do we supplement our human lives, our LDS lives in many cases, with spiritual practices. So that's where we're going a little bit. But we wanted to start off the session with a little bit more experience, just because we've all been sitting in chairs for long hours. This is day three. We tend to be taking in a lot of information. And I want you to notice how your head feels right now. Just bring your awareness to your head space. And you can bring your awareness to your headspace in the context of the conference the last 3 days. How has your head felt the last 3 days up to and including this moment? And don't answer that question with the mind. See if you can answer that question through sensation, just checking in with it. One of the hallmarks of adulthood at this time in the world, in Western culture, is that our attention tends to collapse into our headspace. And what I mean by that is, from the moment we wake up, the majority of our awareness and attention tends to gravitate up towards the head, and we kind of stay there. And once in a while, we'll feel our feet on the ground. Once in a while, we'll hear the song of a bird in a tree. And life pulls us out of ourselves. It expands us out of our head. But then we contract back and have a thought like, oh, what a pretty bird song. I'm late for my next meeting. That was a relaxing moment. Oh, I feel stressed. So we want to just start off this session right and allow you to relax a little bit and feel your awareness start to sprawl out from the head out into the entire body and even beyond the entire body. So I'm going to invite you to your feet again. In your own time, when you're ready, I'm going to invite you to stand. And I'll invite you to just come out into open space here. I'm going to have you walk around a little bit. So just find a little bit of space. It doesn't have to be too much here. This is one of my favorites. It's a really simple practice. You can do it anytime, anywhere, except when you're skydiving. I haven't tried it before, but I bet it works when you're skydiving. So this is called the elephant walk. And normally, like our Western consciousness, we relate to this carpeted floor in a conference center like it's inert, like we're just walking around on some dead rock. But for a moment, we're just going to engage our imaginations and imagine that we're walking on the back of a mighty and stately elephant, this great mother elephant that's as large as the entire planet. And every footstep we take, this mother fills our step. Just see what that does. That's it. That's the practice. So I just want you to walk that way and notice what happens. Every foot you lay on the back of the elephant feels your footsteps. It feels your weight. It feels your heart. So just feel yourself to be in deep relationship walking the elephant's back. Notice what happens to your attention when you're being relational. And as Kelly was inviting us to do, as you're making relationship with this elephant, you can notice your breath as well. Notice if the breath is catching anywhere. Notice if there's anywhere you're holding, anywhere you're tight. And you can just have an intention to really relax and soften. Let this elephant walk be 10% easier. However much effort you're putting into it now, let it be even easier, even less effort. Just feel that sense of ease. Yeah. Beautiful. As you're ready, I want you to just find yourself next to another human being, just next to them. It can be, you know, shoulder to shoulder if you're close. It can be 2 or 3 feet away. Just kind of arrange yourselves until you have a sense of, okay, I'm partnered. Just going to play with this for a moment. If you don't have a partner yet, you can find yourself a partner. And for a moment, I want you to just notice the person next to you, their physical form. First, raise your hand if it's okay if the person next to you checks you out just a little bit. Just kind of gives you the old up and down. And just notice how they're standing, where they're standing in relationship to you. Yeah. And you can notice their face. You know, just the expression on their face. Yeah. And if you pay even closer attention, you might notice how they're breathing. Their posture might give you some clues to like how they're feeling. what they're experiencing in this moment. Yeah. And I always forget to say this, but you can opt out of this. You don't have to do this. Just because I have the microphone doesn't mean you have to do what the idiot with the microphone tells you to do. All right. So you can stay right here, but notice we started on the back of an elephant. We're in deep relationship with this elephant. Sometimes we call her Mother Earth. We're in deep relationship to the mother. And you're in relationship with another human being in this moment. You can just feel them in your space, and you can feel them affecting you and influencing you. And if you want to, you don't have to do this. You're perfect where you are. But if you want to, you can actually face each other a little bit. Just a little bit. I'm going to move for a second. And you don't have to eye gaze. Sometimes people eye gaze, and eye gazing is lovely if you want to do that. But I want you to just shift your attention to a more subtle level and just feel the other person's heart. Right? Just bring all of your awareness for the moment to the other person's field of energy, of emotion. And trust that you're able to do this. It's not, we don't often get this invitation to do this. But if we actually bring our attention to another person's heart, we're often surprised at how much information is there and how much we intuitively know about the other person's being. So for a moment, just allow yourself to feel that. And just relax and keep breathing. And as you're really receiving the influence of the other person, really just standing in their aura and their field, recognize that you too are emanating your own field. Your heart is influencing the other person. So without touching, without even looking at each other, you're actually deeply and mutually affecting one another. And the last step, I'm just going to invite you into one more step and take care of yourselves. You can break contact with the other person at any point, understanding that it's not the person's breath or anything like that. You might just need to take care of yourself for a moment. But if you're willing to take another step, I'd invite you to just meet eyes for a moment. If you're willing to do that for just a moment, you don't have to do this. If the eye gaze is too intense, you can just look down at the ground, but stay in contact with them at that heart level, and that's a beautiful way to do this. But if you feel called to, you can notice when you meet eyes for just a moment that the same awareness that's looking out through your eyes, the same awareness that is aware of seeing this person in this moment, that same awareness is looking back at you through different eyes. So there are two sets of eyes, but there's one awareness. And everything you're feeling in your body in this moment, it's awareness, it's spirit that feels through the body. And you can trust that the other being is also feeling through that same spirit. So just appreciate this. At the physical level, we have our form. At the subtle level, we emanate a particular kind of emotion and energy. And at an even more subtle level of spirit, we have an intuition that the same awareness that is awake through us and experiences through us is awake in the other. Back to what Kelly was sharing, this is the experience of namaste, the light in me that perceives you, sees the light looking back at me. Just let this in whatever way feels appropriate. And I'll invite you to break form and do whatever you want at this point to say hello, say thank you, and we'll find our way back to our seats. take your time luxuriously making your way back to your seat. And we'll stay in this quality of heartfulness, of intimacy, as we start to explore a little bit more of what we mean by supplementary spiritual practices.
I could get up and walk around. I guess it's up to you guys. Would you guys rather have me stand than sit? Because you can see me better, right? If I stand, okay, I'm going to stand. I need to be in my body. So am I doing all three of them right now? Just kind of sharing my keys right now.
You got about 15 to just let
cool.
It rip.
I really needed this because I live in my head. My biggest challenge in life is to move into my body, which I'm still trying to do at this late age. I've always lived in my head. I thought I would talk about three M's, mediation, mysticism, and ministry, really quick, as the three practices I've done on my path outside of scholarship and all my head stuff. Being inactive or non-Mormon for 27 years and then coming back after 27 years of being out on my own path, people often ask me, how do you balance your personal spirituality with church participation? How in the heck do you do that? And my answer is, I always put my own inner spiritual life, my relationship with God first. I did it my whole life. From the time I was a little kid, I kind of always put the church second. It was my relationship with God first. What I felt I was supposed to do came first. Church came second. So for me, coming back to the church after this journey where I just did my own thing, it's a very deep and beautiful discipline to learn how to find balance. Because I was a loner who always pulled my own way, which is why I never got married and never had children. I was always a loner, wanted to be on my own, do my own thing. So I've had to learn how to find balance with others in relationship with them and belong and become one and work together and give up. Kind of what I would rather do with my time. And we all have a different position on this. For some of you, it may be the opposite. Your whole life, you kind of gave in to others and kind of had a hard time finding you. Or maybe a hard time finding your own relationship with God in tension or relationship with what the church was teaching. So I just want to address this first, this tension, and I'll call it mediation. The truth is, we all do this. We all have to do this. We all have to find balance between our own inner identity, path, needs, versus those of those around us, whether it's in our families or our relationships or in academia or in church. Sometimes, as Mormons, we like to think the church is this big, bad, dominating thing that's squashing us all, and we've got to get away from it. But in reality, I have friends with PhDs who've dropped out of academia who talk about academia the same way a lot of ex-Mormons talk about the church. This is true no matter what group you're participating in. You have to find your balance between you and the group. So just for a second, just for a minute here, think about that. Think about, do you have an easier time following your own inner path and kind of letting go of what other people expect or need or want, or do you have an easier time kind of going along with what everybody else wants and a harder time finding your own inner path? Think about that for a minute. We all have to learn to be mediators. I studied mediation and used to mediate legal cases. It's one of the spiritual practices that I wanted to explore along my way. I love mediation, the principles of mediation. And you can use these with church and with family and with anyone in your life. First of all, first step, think about what your inner path is really telling you. Because if you're not in sync with it, if you're ignoring it or repressing it, you're going to be in pain. Our path is written in our soul. Think about some way that your inner path has been trying to communicate with you. And really listen to it, really honor it. think about that. I'll just give you three quick skills for finding your balance between the self and other. The first one is to get that clarity. Be alone. Find a safe, sacred space that is all about you and your inner guidance, apart from everybody and everything else. Find a place, create a place, and a time that's all yours that you're going to go there. And nobody and nothing is going to interrupt that. Because you've got to go to that place. Imagine where that is in your life. I want you to get a really clear image of it. This is going to be your place where you're alone with your inner self or higher self or God. And that's the place where you want to go and first get clarity. Because you'll have to return to that place and get further clarity and further clarity. So create your own sacred space, inner and outer. You need the outer space to help create it for the inner space. You need an outer sacred space that's yours. Step number two is once you get clarity, then approach the person who you're having this, or the group that you're having this tension with, this conflict with, between your needs and their needs and your idea and theirs. And you want to find one thing in common that you agree with, that you can validate, that you agree with them. Find one piece of common ground. And let them know. Validate them. Validate something about what they're doing or saying. Or find one thing about sacrament meeting or Sunday school you actually love, that you can fully support, that will match this inner integrity. Something that you can honestly, truthfully say, I love that. That has value for me. I can support that. And let them know, voice it. The third step then is to bring in your own. So that's where you're the same. You move into harmony. The second one is the balance, the tension, the difference. The third one is voice your own position that is different from theirs. It may be the church, maybe family, maybe spouse. Voice your position as different, but do it in a way that is empathetic. And while you do it, let them know that it's perfectly okay and valid for them to be in a different place, and that you don't have any expectation for them to agree with you or be where you are. Where they are is fine. You totally honor where they are. But here's your spot. You've got to communicate that your position is your own, and it is not incumbent upon them. They don't need to agree with you, and they are free to be in their own place. So try those three little quick principles of mediation to help you find balance between yourself and the other. The second thing I wanted to mention is mysticism. In Mormonism, my favorite spiritual practice of the Mormon tradition is the vision tradition. We are a visionary tradition. Joseph Smith restored an ancient vision tradition, and he practiced it, but he was not alone. He learned from his mother and his neighbors, like Sally Chase. He immersed himself in the vision tradition, the tradition of going inner, the inner vision that communicates within. This is our heritage in Mormonism. It is a visionary tradition. And when people came to the Smith household looking for Joseph Smith, Hiram would answer the door and say, this is a visionary house. I want you to think about that. So for a minute, I want you to think about, do you practice vision, your inner vision? And how do you practice it? What would that look like? This is our heritage, to practice vision. The Old Testament tells us that without vision, the people perish. We need our inner visions. Whether you believe in God or not, and I spent years as an atheist, and I still was visionary and mystic, but I was, at that time in my life, I was atheist. You don't have to believe in God to be a visionary. What do you envision? What do your inner visions look like? How could you open yourself to vision? Have you had waking visions? If you've experienced highway hypnosis, you've experienced a waking vision. How many of you have been driving down the highway and then 5 minutes later you realize, I wasn't here. I was at Sunstone, or I was at my boyfriend's, or I, you know, your mind is completely someplace else. That's highway hypnosis. I studied hypnosis for years as well. Hypnosis is going into your subconscious mind. And that's where our visions are. They come out of the subconscious, and sometimes they overtake us. Allow yourself to relax and go into a place where you are completely free to experience inner vision. Okay, that was the second thing I wanted to mention. The third thing I wanted to mention is ministry. This is also our legacy and our heritage in Mormonism, where every member is a minister. When you're confirmed, if you want to know the powers and authority and ordination you receive, read section 25. That's Emma Smith's confirmation blessing. And it says at the end, what I've said to you applies to all. Read section 25. You're ordained when you're confirmed as a lay minister, preacher, teacher, leader, exhorter of the LDS Church. Do you experiment with your ministry? You don't have to be active in the church to experiment with it. And even if you leave the church, there's still this sense that in some way I'm kind of a minister. What do I do with that? You are a minister. How can you explore this and practice this? Ministry is all around you. Ministry is coming into contact with another person and moving into their space and listening and creating and anchoring a safe space for them to express anything. You are an anchor. You are creating their safe space by letting them know, I'm here, no matter where you are. You may be out in the middle of the lake drowning. You may be planning to off yourself tomorrow. I'm here with you where you are. Tell me where you are. It's safe. You can tell me anything. It will never be shared with anyone. You can tell me anything. That's ministry. You walk out into the lake, and you stand in the middle of the lake with them. And it's not about what you know or believe or where you are or what happened to you an hour ago when somebody was horrible to you. You set all that aside, and you stand in the lake, or you sit with that person, and the two of you have a sacred space that Jesus says in Matthew, wherever two are gathered, there I am in the midst, that the divine and the spiritual will descend because the two of you are mirroring hearts and souls. Be open. Be open to the possibilities. It's like sitting next to someone on an airplane and having an amazing conversation that's life-changing that you never imagined you would have with a person on an airplane. It's like that. Be open to the moments of ministry that can happen between you and another person. I want you to think about that for a minute. Think about a time when you have had a chance encounter with someone you did not know, and the two of you had a conversation, a communion of souls that was life-changing. Think about that. Can you think of a time? So I just wanted to share those three practices. They embody my work as a mediator and a mystic and a minister. And these are practices that you can do that you don't have to be trained to do. And they are our legacy as lay ministers and visionaries and mediators. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Maxine.
All right, I just wanted to begin with a quote that I'd like you guys to keep in mind as I'm sharing a little bit of my story and what I experience as a yoga teacher. It's kind of a unique perspective. It's dealing with people one-on-one. It's as they go through their journey, I simply get to share in their journey. And that's kind of how I see it, as a little bit of someone who sits at the front of the room and makes suggestions, really, of how to breathe and what postures to hold. And I find that as the more that I teach, the more people want to open up. The more they come into these classes and the more they connect with themselves, the more they connect with other people. And I'd like to share this quote really quick before I share some of my personal history. You were born with potential. You were born with goodness and trust. You were born with ideals and dreams. You were born with greatness. You were born with wings. You were not meant for crawling, so don't. You have wings. Learn to use them and fly. This is by Rumi. He's one of my favorite ancient theologians. And he's helped me through a lot of hard times. When I was 6 years old, we moved into a new house out in West Jordan, Taylorsville area. And as I was playing out in my front yard, the three teenage boys that lived next door invited me over for some fruit punch and then proceeded to rape me. All three of them. I lived next to them for the next 10 years. When I was 8, I told my mom what had happened to me, because at 8, we have that special time where we become accountable. We receive the gift of the Holy Ghost, and we become accountable for what it is we do. And I came to my mom hoping that I could clear my conscience, because even at this young age, I knew that what had happened to me had, in the way that I had been hearing about it in church, had turned me into a licked cupcake or a chewed up piece of gum, as it were. Some of these things that we've heard growing up and maybe even said. And I understood this at a young age. And so I came to my mom and I told her, this is what's happened to me. And she said, I don't believe you. You made it up. You've seen something on TV. You've seen a Michael Jackson video or something and made it up. And it's pop culture that's worked its way into your brain. The devil has worked his way into your brain. And you're telling me a story for I'm not sure what reason, she thought. Now, as my mom was saying this to me, I realized that she was protecting something so precious to her, more precious than me. She was protecting her faith. She was protecting her structure. She grew up having polio. She grew up not knowing if she would ever get married or have children. She could not let that go. And these three boys were the sons of the bishop in our ward. And she could not create waves. She could not jeopardize that structure in her life. And I realized, I didn't know it then, but as I grew up, I came to understand more and more completely why she had to do this. And I came to a place where I could forgive. And we are now on wonderful terms, and we speak often, and I understand where she was coming from. But for an 8-year-old girl to come into the realization that I was alone. I was alone and broken and used up and not worthy anymore. It sat with me for years and years and years, and I never dealt with it until I hit about 32 years old. And I had two children, two beautiful toddlers of my own, an amazing husband. And one day I started having rolling panic attacks. Complete and total debilitating panic attacks. Unable to leave the house, unable to drive a car. I would leave full shopping carts of groceries at the Walmart or the Smith's. I tried different grocery stores to see if it would work in different places. But the moment that I got to the front of the store with my full shopping cart and saw a line and knew that I had to wait and sit with myself, I abandoned my shopping cart and ran out the door. And the people in my neighborhood and the people in the stores knew who I was, and they would simply take that shopping cart and put all those things back for me. And for about 9 months, I had been practicing yoga for a little bit before this time. And as this all started to unfold, it came to a head to where I could not leave my home, and I couldn't take care of my kids. And as I had been practicing, I realized for the 6 months before that I had been practicing, I had been asked to look deeply inside myself, look into my own heart, look into my own mind, and see what was there. And it scared the hell out of me because I found all of that that I had pushed away for so long. I found that little girl who was still frightened. I found that little girl whose mother told her, "I don't believe you." And I broke. I broke into about what seemed like a million pieces. And for 9 months, I tried to find a medical reason why I was feeling so bad. I went to every doctor on the planet. My poor husband paid upwards of $20,000 in medical bills, and no doctor could tell me what was wrong. Neurologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists, endocrinologists, everyone you can think of, every gist that you can think of, I went to it. Until my second neurologist told me, there's no problem in your physical self. You need to see a psychiatrist. This is what's happening. And so I went and spoke with a psychiatrist, and he said, you know, I understand that you're having panic attacks. I understand that you're frightened. I understand that you are moving through this world in a very scared way. And I said, yes. And he says, well, good, because the world's a scary place. Let's figure out how you can exist here in your wholeness with your brokenness. In my wholeness with my brokenness. No one had ever said that to me before. Embrace your brokenness. There's a Japanese art called kintsugi, where they mend their bowls with gold. They mend the cracks in the bowls with gold so that they shine more brightly after they've been broken. And they find them to be more interesting after they've been broken. And that's where they fill these cracks with gold, with this beautiful shining gold. And I started to realize my brokenness is a part of me. It's not something that I should squash down or be ashamed of. It's something that I can turn around and use if I can only find a pathway to get there. So I started going back to yoga. And it took me a long time. I had to go and sit in my street clothes because I was sitting on the mat having panic attacks. So I just sit in street clothes in the back of the room, kind of rocking back and forth. And, you know, people practicing yoga just there for a night of good yoga going, what's up with this lady? So it took a little while, but I began practicing again, and I put myself back together in a way that I found to be my true and most authentic self. And I continue to work on it every day and with every practice. And during that time, the teachers that sat at the front of the room, they opened the door, and while I stood in the door and said, can I come in? Am I welcome here? Is this a safe space? They said, yes, come in each their own way. Said, yes, please come in. You're welcome here. Practice in whatever way you need to. Sit in child's pose, sit at the back of the room, cry, whatever it is you need to do, practice your practice. And so many wonderful people said that to me, that as I began to know that I had the strength to put myself back together the way that I needed to, in a way that I could help other people, I began to have a desire to help other people, to reach out, and I became a yoga teacher. I went through 2 years of training in Anusara Yoga, which is alignment-based and heart-based yoga, so that I could be the person at the front of the room that when someone walks in and says, am I okay to come in? Am I welcome here? That I could say, yes, come in. You're safe. You can say anything. This is your safe space. And I've had the absolute privilege of witnessing so many people of all different faiths, of all different backgrounds, come to my classes and walk away feeling empowered. Someone who walks in who hasn't attempted a headstand since they were a little child, and they do a handstand. They didn't know they could, and they maybe do a handstand against the wall and feel that power welling up inside of them, knowing how strong they are. And just for a moment, they feel that they can tackle something else in their life, something off the mat, outside of that room. And I see it happen over and over and over again. There was a wonderful Hindu woman who came to my class, and she had just gotten a divorce. And in that culture, it's very, very it's a hard thing to get a divorce for a woman. And she went into a deep depression. She couldn't come to my class without her mom sitting in the back. Her mom flew from India to be with her for a few months. And she would sit in the back of these classes she'd come to for a couple of months. And Priya kept coming to these classes, continued coming to my classes, continued practicing, and eventually her mom didn't come with her anymore. And I said, well, where is she? I love your mom. Where, you know, we'd get to chatting, and I would wonder where she went. She says, she went home to India. I don't need her anymore. She told me I was strong enough, and I knew it, and she flew home. And it was through her practice of yoga that she was able to find strength in herself, to find that, notice the brokenness, know it, allow it to be a part of her, and put herself back together. And then turn around, and she has now become a yoga teacher. And I'm so proud to say that I got to be a part of her path. She did the hard work. She chopped the wood and carried the water, and it was just me making suggestions at the front of the room. But I am honored and blessed that I get to sit in that seat of the teacher on a regular basis. And I have seen so many people find their way back into wholeness through this practice of yoga. So it is close to my heart. It is close to, it is the closest thing I've found to supplementing spiritual practice. If you're looking, how can I bolster up my spiritual side? It is what I would highly recommend from my own personal experience and from what I see in these amazing warriors, champions that walk through the door and at first ask, can I come in? And I say, yes, please do. Thank you.
Really beautiful to listen to your words. Thank you both. I'm mindful of the time, so we've been here together for an hour now. It's about 3. And my sense is in this session, maybe more than most sessions, there's a lot of content in the crowd and a lot of questions and desire to explore different conversations and possibilities around spiritual practice. Is that true? Do you guys have questions out there and ideas and things that you hope that we discuss? Give me some sign of life if that's true. All right, I'm getting some yeses and some difficult to interpret looks on people's faces. I want to be brief. So I've been kind of considering what I might talk about for this panel the last week, and I actually I'm a little surprised by what I want to talk about, so I'm going to talk about it for a moment. And then my intention is to leave plenty of time to have a spirited conversation in a community of brothers and sisters about what does it mean to, you know, supplement our spiritual lives, because I know there's a lot of wisdom in the crowd as well. So I'm going to try to explain a somewhat complex idea in 5 to 10 minutes. I'm going to start with a question. How many people in this room would consider obeying the commandments of spiritual practice? You can be honest. You can raise your hand. Raise them really high if you think yes. How many people think maybe? It depends. And how many people feel more confident about, no, I don't consider that a spiritual practice? Some people. Yeah, okay. Given that we haven't defined spiritual practice yet, it could be yes, no, and maybe, legitimately. So quickly, I know some of you in this room. For those who I haven't met, I left the church not dissimilar to Kelly here. I left the church when I was 13 years old and grew up in a really devout Mormon family. I was really fortunate to be essentially adopted by a Buddhist sangha, which sangha is kind of the counterpart to the way we use the word ward, like a ward family. So I was taken in by a Buddhist community, and it became a very profound spiritual home to me for years. It continues to be. A lot of my upbringing and formation has come through the Buddhist tradition, and I very much claim it as one of my native languages in spiritual life. It's interesting to me that a pattern in Buddhism is very explicit. I'm going to use 3 Sanskrit words here. I'll describe them, and then I'm going to relate it back to Mormonism. Some of you might know them. If not, you're going to learn 3 new vocabulary words in this session today. So sila, samadhi, prajna. Anybody? Does that ring a bell? Any of them? Sila, in the Buddhist tradition, refers to moral precepts. It's quite close to the way that we think about commandments, or it's close in terms of concrete practices that we adopt. Sila is S-I-L-A, for those interested. And if I can rattle them off, I can't name the Ten Commandments. I might be able to name the five moral precepts. They're just more memorable, and at least to me. Do no harm with your language. In other words, tell no lies. Take nothing that doesn't belong to you. Don't steal. Refrain from intoxicants, drugs, alcohol, anything that clouds the mind. Do not kill. Do not take another being's life, whether human or otherwise. And the last one is do no harm with your sexual energy. And we could have a whole panel on sila and what this means. I see a smiling back like, ooh, let's talk about how to use our sexual energy. That'll wake us up. Here's what's interesting to me. As someone who's a bit of a kind of bicultural in the religious and spiritual sense, I was born in a Mormon family, and I, you know, was educated in Mormonism up to about age 12, so it's somewhere that's in me as a native language. But I also hold Buddhism really deeply. And in Buddhism, sila is really important. The moral precepts are really important. But here's the catch. This is a different perspective that I think sheds a lot of light on life in Mormonism, that Buddhism is non-theistic. So in other words, if you do harm by telling a lie, if you take another life, if you harm another or yourself with sexual energy, God's not going to get upset about it because, well, we have no opinion about whether or not there is a God in the first place. So this changes the game a little bit. If I can put this question to you all, when we obey commandments in the Mormon church, what tends to be the impetus? What tends to be the motivation? What tend to be the consequences if we don't obey the commandments? Shout it out. Help me out here. What happens? You offend God. Sure. Yeah. Anything else come up? Guilt. We feel guilt. Thank you. Yeah. Punishment. Right? This is good. Any others? Okay. So you're dirty. You have dirt on you. Good. Anything else? Punishing after. I love crowdsourcing questions. They're such good perspectives. So imagine that's basically out the door now in Buddhism because there's no theistic framework. There's no one that's going to punish you. The progression in Buddhism, we start with sila, the moral concepts, and that's considered a preparatory spiritual practice to settle the body-mind. So the next step is samadhi, and this is a complex term, and it's a rich, you know, many-faceted experience, but it basically refers to concentration. It's considered to be very important in Buddhist spiritual practice and formation to be able to come to a place of calmness, stillness, and to steady the mind. And what they learned, I think empirically, by empirically I mean they just did trial and error for many centuries. And what they found is that when you lie to somebody, if you lie to your next door neighbor like, hey, have you seen my lawnmower? I haven't seen it. And then you spend the rest of the day nervous, like, what if they find out that their lawnmower is in my garage? Like, to tell a lie, we have to hold a particular asana, an uncomfortable yoga posture, where we can't quite relax because we're afraid that other people find out that we're lying, right? If we take another person's life, there are implications to the emotional state of often anger, or a total lack of compassion that would have driven us to that state of being able to take a life. And so what they found through trial and error is that these precepts, they're not precepts that are enforced by any higher power per se. They're preparatory spiritual practices that allow us to relax. If I'm being responsible sexually, and if I'm doing no harm with my speech, and if I'm not taking possessions that don't belong to me, I can kind of walk about the world a little more relaxed, a little bit less defended. Does that make sense? Can you feel that in your body? Can you imagine if, you know, if you're living that way, that You haven't offended anybody. You're not doing harm. And the world naturally responds to you in a way like, oh, this person, I can trust them. I get a good feeling from them. And the Buddhists recognize that, okay, that prepares the body-mind for samadhi, for deep concentration. And I realize, like, I get into these trances when I start talking, and the time flies by, and I have just a couple more minutes. So what I want to say is that there's a whole sweep and progression of meditative practice that helps us cultivate insight. So samadhi or concentration allows us to see deeply with insight into the way things are. What's real? What's true? What's so? And as we do that, we open the door of wisdom, the wisdom gate, or prajna in the Buddhist tradition. And prajna is difficult to describe. But go back to an experience in your life. It might have been today. It might be in this moment. It might have been sometime in the last few years, where you just have a moment, and everything feels incredibly simple and intimate. You don't feel confused at all. There's nothing to work out in your mind. You're not trying to understand something with the mind, per se. It's like simultaneously... You have this experience like you're part of this grand whole that is the manifest universe. You're not just part of it, but you're intimately one with it. And so there's no fear, and there's no resistance, and you feel a total peace with yourself. It's something like that. I'm reminded of the words of the poet Walt Whitman when he says, "Now, in a moment, I know what I am for." We all have those moments of clarity. And in the Buddhist tradition, this sila, these basic practices, prepare us for meditation, and the meditation allows us to see in a moment what we're really for. And we spontaneously grasp the truth, the beauty, and the goodness of our lives, and of all lives, and of all beings, etc. So there's a progression there. I'm going to come back to Mormonism, then we're going to open it up to a discussion. In Mormonism, what strikes me, I'm the ironic Worthland McConkie convert to Mormonism. I actually can tell people with a straight face that, yes, I'm a McConkie and I'm a convert to Mormonism. And I've been back in the church for a few years, and it's striking to me, like the commandments to me, it just immediately struck me like this is preparatory. And preparatory doesn't mean we leave them behind. Because in Buddhism, when you have had an insight into the intimacy of all things, it doesn't mean you can go around killing people now. It means less than ever you have a desire to go against the moral precepts. But they become more automatic. Right? You don't obey them out of a sense of duty or fear of punishment. It's just not in your nature to wish to do harm to anything. So the commandments are striking to me that if I look closely at Mormon doctrine and Mormon practice, all the cookie crumbs are there, actually. Like the same progression that I just described simply in Buddhism, we follow the commandments in Mormonism. And there's a lot of, I want to just say, baggage around it. We could talk about the baggage. And then when it comes to samadhi, there are not a lot of obvious connections, at least to me. I'd love to be challenged here, but to me the connections aren't obvious that if you obey the commandments, you will be able to relax more deeply. You will be able to steady your mind, and you will be able, with that steadied, concentrated mind, you will be better able to tolerate divine light. There's not a lot of language about that in the Mormon tradition. And if we're able to really stabilize ourselves, like just be ready and watch for the Spirit. And as the Spirit descends, we start to get this insight into Scripture, like we see in section 93 and 88, that there's a light, there's an immensity of space in creation, and the divine light and intelligence pours out through all of this space and animates and illuminates all things. We don't hear necessarily that if we steady ourselves in prayer, that over time we will recognize that we are exactly that same light. So this progression is a little bit lost. And the focus ends up being on the preparatory phase of obedience, obedience to the commandments. So I wanted to share this. I think it's provocative, so I wanted to share it for that reason. And it's also my deep hope as someone, I actually feel more love and affection for a church that I was deeply hurt by at a young age than I could have imagined. I'm shocked that I care as much about the church as I do and love the church as much as I do. And it's my deep hope and a part of my own Buddhist vows to share this. Like these very plain and simple truths that every person in this room bears the light of Christ. Every person in this room has Buddha nature. And you are fundamentally awake. Not just awake, because awake sounds impersonal. We're not just awake, but we are loving wakefulness. When we really feel awake and we touch into our wakefulness, our heart breaks for humanity and for manifestation. Everything. We're intimate with everything. To me, that's the good news. We call it the Dharma in Buddhism. It's the ineffable cosmic principle in Buddhism. We call it the gospel and the good news. To me, I don't care what we call it, but that we be it and that we share it in community means everything. So my heart yearns for that, and I feel grateful to be able to share that with you. And I'll leave it open to questions now. Thank you. You can come ask questions. They like to get you on a microphone so that it's recorded. Thank you.
We face you whatever you like.
Trust your Buddha nature.
One of the things that I see, it's on, isn't it? Yes? Okay. One of the things that I see different that I'm trying to meld with that is when I've been taught that direction with meditation versus Joseph or Enos or Nephi, you know, pondering, you know, that it's always, in LDS way, it seems to me anyway, that it's always a way of seeking with question, you know, purposeful question to get revealed nature, revealed teachings from God. You know, and when I see the Buddha way, it seems more of a just an openness, creating an emptiness to say, fill me. You know, I'll be nothing. I'll be open. I'll create a chamber inside of my soul to be open to whatever like you say, you don't necessarily have a God there, but in our sense, there being gods there to open us. But I, you know, how do you see those two working together and connecting? That's one of my questions, and because I get too caught up in timing and everything too, trying to do it,
yeah,
do it
that's
right.
Good. I'll take that question since it's Buddhist-oriented, but you can jump in too, Kelly. One thing that comes to mind, what was your name?
Dave,
thanks for the question. One thing I really appreciate about working across, you know, Buddhism is a Vedic religion. Christianity is an Abrahamic religion. And Vedic and Abrahamic religions comprise the two major religious families on the planet. And I appreciate working across, you know, that line. I think it's rewarding to engage different styles and aesthetics of religious practice. Coming to Christianity, I noticed that there's more of a second person approach. We would call it an integral theory. Don't worry about integral theory if you don't know about it. Just ignore I even said that word. But it's second person is the elephant walk. It's how we started this hour. It's recognizing that we're in relationship. And so it's one thing to come into relationship with the ultimate, to come into relationship with divinity. And we all know what it's like to be in intimate relationship. It lights our humanity up. It's an incredible experience to be intimately engaged in relationship. And Christianity beautifully discloses and elaborates that relationship. So there's that piece. And then I notice in Buddhism that there's more of a preference aesthetically for a first-person approach, meaning it's the I am. We see it in Christianity when Christ says, "I am that I am." We say, "Oh, that's awesome. What would that be like?" And we forget that we also are, we also am, right? That we can take a first-person approach to spirituality, not being in relationship with God, but actually taking, adopting that first-person stance as, "I am the light that lights up the entire world." And even as I say that in this space, I'm aware of, you know, like someone out there is crying heresy, because we're not supposed to talk like that. So that's a whole other conversation. But to keep my response brief, I'll just say that I feel deeply rewarded by the relational aspect of divinity that I can come into relationship with. But if I'm stuck in relationship, I don't ever get to just rest in I am-ness. And I love that. And when I rest in I am-ness for eternity, this is Ken Wilber's comment. He's a funny writer. He says, well, God gets lonely and he wants to have a dinner party, have some friends over. So you hang out as I am for eternity. It's like, it'd be nice to have some people over. And I kind of want to be in relationship again. So I think it's beautiful. It reminds me of this concept in Sanskrit, lila, which is the divine play. The divine play, the infinite creation is willing to be God, the first person. It's willing to be in relationship and in a multiplicity of beings. And they're all beautiful opportunities to engage our own spirituality. And we'll be attracted to some at certain times in our lives and others at other times. But I think they're all just incredible displays of light. So thanks for that. I appreciate the question. Yeah.
Years ago, I was fortunate enough to be involved in a small yoga class that was loaded with potential for meditation and spirituality. But since then, I have not found a similar space. So I was hoping I could get some feedback on how to find that.
Sure. Come on back up. I have more questions for you. So what was the space that this was created in? Was this a workshop? Was it a class, public class?
It was a single teacher, and she taught in the back of a Provo Good Earth for a few years in their small back, dirty kind of storage room. But they turned the lights down low, and it was just slower paced and seemed less about ego and comparison than other yoga places that I've been.
And that was what drew you to the space and created the safety for you, was the separation of ego, and like there's nobody was showing off their Lululemon pants and all that while they were there.
Yeah, that's what kept me going.
So the best way I can explain is that is where I teach is I won't teach in those bigger studios, because this style of yoga that I teach is called Anusara, because it is based on letting the ego go. And a lot of times you'll find these yoga studios that are focused on getting as many bodies in the door as possible, and they're focused on being trendy. And they have all the statues, they have all the good stuff around you, but they don't know what they mean. So what I would encourage is look for smaller studios where it's dedicated to yoga and maybe therapeutic massage, that's sometimes included, and find those smaller spaces. I've taught at larger spaces downtown, and I find that there's a very big disconnect because the intention is very different. The intention of someone coming to a yoga class in full makeup and beautiful clothes is very different from someone coming and rolling out their mat and saying, "I really need to connect with myself right now." And so if you want to see me afterwards, I can give you some places that I like to go that I find that this energy and this intention is present, because it does make a very big difference. It and the teacher makes a big difference. Is the teacher there to show you all the cool poses, as I call them, yoga party tricks? You know, are they there to show you all their yoga party tricks, or are they there to be a guide for you? And that's, you kind of have to search for it sometimes, but those are the classes that bring your heart, mind, and spirit together. And you can find it again, whether it's in the back of a grocery store. I taught in the upstairs of a children's gymnastics place called Black Diamond Gym for 4 years. And it was a tiny room, 1/4 the size of this room, and it was where I preferred to teach, regardless of any other job offers I received, because that space, it held the love and care that was needed for people to be safe. So come see me afterwards, and I can make some recommendations. But if you're out looking on your own, definitely look for those spaces where you go in and you feel welcome, and you feel like the ego is not a bad thing unless it's running the show. If the ego's running the show, then everything else is going to be driven by that. And if you can find a place that's driven by dharma, by purpose, by heart, then that's where you want to be, because that's going to be a space where you're allowed your own path instead of being dragged along somebody else's path, is really what's happening in those big spaces where the teacher is center stage and going, okay, I'm going to drag all of you people in this room along with me, and if you can't do it, too bad. It's more of a, okay, this is a space where this is your yoga practice, and I honor that I get to be a small part of it. So as you go on your search, keep searching. Don't give up. They're out there. You'll find it again, and I can help you find it.
Yeah. Hi. I'm fascinated and maybe even a little bit perplexed by, I'm not sure of your journey, Kelly, but that the two of you returned to Mormonism after a time, mostly because I'm trying to navigate my way through, at times wanting to leave. So my question is, it sounds like you both had rich practices and things that filled you for that time that you were away. Did Mormonism draw you back as a supplement? Did it draw you back because you were missing something?
Sure. Well, you got to say something about this talk. You have to share some of it. That's a great question. And first of all, let me just say that I really honor your struggle and your pain. And I encourage and bless you to honor it fully and listen to your inner guidance. We need to honor each other's journeys. We need to be free to explore other traditions outside of Mormonism. Joseph Smith was exploring all of them and trying to weave them together. And we need to be free to take breaks or go elsewhere if that's what we need. And we all need to honor each other in that way. But for me, it's a new phase of my path. I didn't feel anything was lacking. I was really just fine where I was, and I didn't really feel a need to come back. And then God sort of intervened and spent a year sort of arguing with me arguing with God, whatever, about, do I really need to go back there? I don't see any reason why I need to go back. And that higher wisdom that guides me in my life, you know, all my life, through all the places on my path, and through my excommunication, the voice and the guidance that was there for me, counseled me for a whole year and explained to me a little bit more about what I shared with you, that I had never belonged. I hadn't belonged to my family. I hadn't found my place in academia. I didn't belong in the church. I didn't belong anywhere. And God said, you need to learn how to belong and to be appreciated for who you are and to be fully present. I love the work that Julie Hanks is doing on this. She's really good at, in her work, articulating how we hold on to ourselves and be fully ourselves and be in relationship, the I am and the relationship at the same time. I wasn't good at that. So for me, it's a deeper spiritual discipline. You know, Thomas is laughing because he gets it. Mormonism is a deeper spiritual discipline. It's like, I see it as sort of this third or fourth phase of my life where now I'm doing synthesis. I started out in thesis and then I went off into antithesis for many years, and now I'm doing synthesis. I'm weaving it together, and it's a deeper, deeper work to learn how to be fully me, but fully in relationship with these people in this organization who I love. And it's beautiful. But that's where I'm at. We're all in different places in our journey. We all have different, as Jung would say, superior functions and inferior functions in our personality, things we need to develop and things that are very developed. You know, it's really important to discover where you are and what your needs are and then figure out where you need to be to develop those inferior functions, to find balance, to find healing. Nobody's got a map for you. The map is in you. And you just need people who love you to help you find that map and follow it. So that's what I would say.
2 minutes. So I'll say a word on this, and maybe we could take these next two questions privately after we conclude the session. Would that be okay?
I was just going to ask a quick question. Most of the yoga I've done is Bikram, but because it doesn't hurt me. But I want to be more literate about the yoga traditions and some of the ideas, but there's such an array. It's a little overwhelming, and I was wondering if you had any book recommendations.
I do. Okay. See me afterwards, and I'll write them down for you. I have a lot of books that are very good. The first one is The Untethered Soul. I can tell you that one. And I would recommend that one for anyone in the room. The Untethered Soul is an amazing one, and I'll write some more down. So, yeah.
I just was looking for more atheist spirituality options. And, of course, Buddhism is a non-theistic tradition, and yoga is also. But I was intrigued by yours, Maxine. Wanted to know more about that.
Again, afterwards, let's talk. I can share a lot of what I was doing in my years as an atheist.
And I still have 30 seconds, thanks to these lovely ladies who are so courteous. Well, I'll just say to this question about, like, why go back, there's a lot to say about it. One thing I'll say is that it wasn't a conscious conceit on my part. I kind of washed up on shore, you know, in a Mormon chapel. That's one piece. And as I reflect on that moment, it was about 6-7 years ago now, it occurs to me that the Mormon Church has been the most painful experience in my life growing up. And to me, there's something poetic and something intelligent about life and grace that will take me back to the very source and epicenter of my pain. And in giving myself to, you know, this current of grace, I feel redemption in it. It's like, oh, this is what utter abject pain feels like. And it points me to the part of me that's unbreakable, to take me into my deepest brokenness. It's pointed to the part of me that's completely beyond breaking.
Thank you so much for joining us for this session. Let's thank Kelly Thomas and Maxine.